Go ahead and turn to Ruth with me. Chapter 2. We started chapter 1 of Ruth last week. It takes place in the time of the judges, as you remember, which was a dark time in Israel's history due to their constant apostasy and oppression. We saw that as we read through the book of Judges. And then there's this shining beacon of light, if you will, in the middle of that, through this small 4-chapter book of Ruth. Famine hits the land in Israel, and so a man named Elimelech actually takes his wife Naomi and his 2 sons, and he heads to a land of Moab, enemies of the Israels, where the land was fertile, plenty of rain. They headed there just for a short time to seek food and probably shelter to some degree. But tragedy strikes. While they're in Moab, Elimelech and his sons all die. Now the two sons had married 2 Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. But they're left alone along with Naomi, widows, left alone with no one to care for them, no one to provide for them. And so again, it was a tragic time for them. Remember that they went back to, they finally decided to leave and go back to Israel. God had lifted the famine. It's probably one of those cycles that we saw in the book of Judges where God was now relieving the oppression of the Israelites. And so they hear about that and they decide to head back. And as you remember the story, Naomi tries to get her 2 daughters-in-law to go back to Moab. And we saw that that was partly because of her concern over them. She had nothing to offer them. She knew that they would be widows in a foreign land. And it's bad enough for widows in Israel, let alone to be foreigners and widows in the land of Israel. And so she encouraged them to go back. Orpah goes back, but Ruth clings to her, we're told, and basically says, I can't go back. Because your God is my God and your people are my people, and God forbid that I should separate from you. And so we see this amazing picture of Ruth's loyalty and her faithfulness to Naomi. And as we saw, that actually represents something in the book, because Ruth is actually a picture of the church. She's a type, as they call it, an example of the church. And so we saw her demonstrating her faithfulness, which again is a reflection of God's faithfulness as a church. So we're going to dive into chapter 2 this morning. We're going to continue the story. And it's going to introduce us to another character, a man by the name of Boaz. So go ahead and turn with Ruth chapter 2 with me. And we look at the first verse. It says, "Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz." Now what's interesting about this is just an introductory verse. It's telling us about something we need to know as we get into the rest of this chapter. And it introduces us to this man named Boaz, and the New American Standard says that he was a kinsman. Some of your translations may say that he was actually a relative, which is a more literal term. But we find out a little bit later that he's actually a kinsman, and we're going to describe that a little bit later in the book. It says that he was from the family, or some translations translate it as clan. The text isn't really clear here, but Boaz was clearly a relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech. We don't know, however, was he a cousin, was he an uncle, was he a distant relative. We just know that he was from either the clan or the family. The way that the tribes were broken down is you had the tribe, then within the tribe you had clans, and those clans were made up of families. So we know that he's somewhere in that line. He's a relative of some sort, and a little bit later we'll find out that he's a specific kind of relative. So maybe a cousin, maybe a brother, we're not really sure. Now a little bit later in chapter 3 and chapter 4, he's referred to as a brother. But we have to be cautious. That term was used among Israelites, much like we use it today when we say he's a brother or sister in Christ. So even though the text later on calls him a brother, we don't know if that means he's a literal brother or if he was just a fellow Israelite. We know that to be the case for sure there. But it also says in the text here that he was a man of great wealth. And more literally, it said that he's a man of standing or a prominent, well-respected man in the community, which... the reason why some of these translations translated as a man of wealth is because they pretty much had to be wealthy to be a prominent man. He was well connected. We see that a little bit later as he sits at the gate. But he was a property owner, which also means that he was probably fairly wealthy. We know that he had servants and employees. So we have basically this businessman, a fairly prominent man in the community that's a relative of Elimelech. And we learn that just from that one first verse. But what now happens in verse 2 is it sort of like starts over. meaning we get this little introductory verse, something you need to know that's going to happen a little bit later. So they tell us about this man Boaz, because a little bit later here we're going to discover something about him. And so it's just kind of a cursory introductory story. And the reason that's important is because you're going to notice that some of your translations in verse 2, it starts off with the word and or so, seeming to indicate that Naomi knew who Boaz was and deliberately sends Ruth over to Boaz. And that's not true at all. We find out that in the text that Naomi and Ruth didn't know the field that Ruth was going to go into. So this is just an introductory verse. The word and there is, some of your translations don't even translate it because it doesn't exist in the original text. So my point is that, again, verse 1 is just this introduction to us, okay? So sort of look at it as there's some foreshadowing taking place here, and the story now really starts in verse 2. It says, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, 'May the Lord be with you.' And they said to him, 'May the Lord bless you.' Then Boaz said to his servants, who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' The servant in charge of the reapers replied, 'She is a young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab.' And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather from among the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while." So what we basically find here is that Ruth heads out to glean the fields. Now this is important because, remember, she's a widow. She didn't have anybody to support her, to help her, and back at this time in history, it was critical because women on their own were taken care of by their family, their father primarily, or their husband. It's not like today where they went out and had a career typically. Now, that doesn't mean that women didn't work and didn't have careers. Proverbs 31 makes that pretty clear, but always in the context of a family. And so we have these two, these two widows, Naomi and Ruth, with no protection. And so Ruth, when she gets to Israel, realizes that she has to do something to support Naomi and herself. So she asks, "Let me go out, find a field, and glean in it." Now what's interesting is that the Old Testament law specifically established rules for this. Deuteronomy chapter 24, you don't have to turn there, but you might make a note. Deuteronomy 24 verses 19 through 21 explains in detail that if you owned property and you were a farmer, that when you would send out the people into the field, you had to leave the corners of the field unharvested. And that was so that the poor and the widows could go and reap from that. But in addition, when you went through the field and the stuff that had fallen on the ground, you couldn't collect back up. You had to leave it there on the ground. And again, it was so that the poor in the community could come into those fields. And so the farmers were under strict rules to basically make sure that they left something for those that needed it, that weren't protected, that didn't have the care that they needed. And so that's exactly what Ruth is doing here. She recognizes she needs to go out to the field and glean those corners or pick up the scraps of the grain that was left on the ground. Now, it wasn't safe to do that. Now, you would think that God's people would obey God's commands, but not everybody was happy about having parts of their field scavenged by those people. So they didn't always leave the corners of the field. They didn't always leave the stuff on the ground. And it's actually alluded to here in the text, because Naomi indicates in verse 22 of chapter 2 here that it was dangerous for Ruth to go off and do this. So she basically says she wants to go and find a place where she would find favor among somebody. In other words, what she's saying is, let me go find somebody that's willing to let me glean in the fields, because not everybody would do that. So we find here, if we look at verse 3, it says that, "So she departed," Naomi gave her permission, and saying, Ruth departed, and she went and she gleaned in the field after the reapers, and it says here that she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. How many of you have a different translation to read something else there? Anybody? What's interesting about the phrase here, what does it say there? There you go. As it turned out, or, and it so happened. The word that's used here is the word for chance. And here's what's interesting about this. The author is using it in an ironic way. It's almost like the author is saying, and it just so happens that she ends up in Boaz's field. Now remember, she didn't know who Boaz was. She didn't know about that he was the kinsman redeemer yet. We get a little bit confused because that first verse tells us who he is, but remember, that's just an introductory note by the author to give us some details about him. But when she sets out, she's just saying, I just got to go find a field where somebody will let me reap. And the author says, and it just so happened. Just by chance, she ends up in Boaz's field. That's critical for our story today. So she ends up in Boaz's field here. And look at what happens. Verse 4, as she's gleaning in the field, it says she's following after the reapers. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. That's critical too, because we find in this, I told you last week that we're going to see in these characters, every one of these characters has something we can emulate. And this is a man, if you look at his language here, he walks into the field and he blesses his workers. And they in turn bless him back. That was not a common thing. They weren't always treated very well, the people that would work the fields. And so here's a man, you get this picture where he's glad to see the folks in the field, and he's gracious and kind to them, and their response to him is they're gracious and kind, they're happy to see him. So we already get an indication of how this might turn out for Ruth. And as he's there, verse 5 says, he says to his servants, whose woman is this? Because he's got a man, maybe a manager if you would call it that, that's responsible for hiring those who go out in the field and reap. And as Boaz is looking across his field, he sees this woman walking behind the reapers. And it makes him wonder, well, who is this? So his servant says to him, verse 6, she's the young woman, the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. So she had already had a reputation of sorts. They knew who Naomi was. They knew who Ruth was. Verse 7, she said to me, or she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. So what we basically see here is that Boaz sees her in the field. We find out that she had come and she had asked for permission to glean in the field. And the manager of the reapers had given her permission to do that. Which again gives you an indication of how he felt about his master. He recognized that Boaz would have permitted that. Again, we get this interesting little side note about how Boaz probably treated his employees. And so they went ahead and they let her do it. And she had been there all day, and now she's kind of sitting probably in the shade, relaxing a little bit, because gleaning was hard work. You're out there in the heat. You're sweaty. You're smelly. You have to wait as people move ahead of you and pick up their scraps. And imagine as she's doing this, she's carrying this stuff. And so she's probably in the shade now, taking a little bit of a rest. And Boaz happens to catch her eye. And so she's out there gleaning. Sees her. Permits it to happen. Let me get to verse 8. We're going to see now what Boaz does about this. And there's four acts of kindness that we actually see here by Boaz. At least four different acts of kindness. The first act of kindness comes in verse 8 and 9. It says, then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. So Boaz now walks out to the field probably, or to the field house where she was resting, pulls her aside and says, okay, stay here. And only glean in my field. Boaz knew what it was like probably in the other fields. Knew that a young woman like this was probably at risk. Was probably a dangerous place. And so he says, don't go anywhere else. Stay here and glean only in my fields. But he takes it a step further because he says, I've told my servants not to harass you. Gives us an indication too of what the servants often might have done. Now think about in the average field back then. You have a master who hires his managers to work his field. And then they hire some workers who go out there. And there was probably a pretty good amount of pressure to pick up every last scrap and to glean those fields. And if you see somebody off in the corner, reaping the corners, to chase them away, because you obviously want your master to be happy with the job you've done. And so the servants were likely oftentimes not only reapers, but people that protected the field, chased away the riffraff, made sure that people didn't come in and steal from the owner of the field. And so he instructs his own guys, hey, look, don't harass her. Let her do what she's going to do. But he does something else interesting here. You notice what he tells her she can do? She can actually drink from the same thing that his own people drink from. Again, something you would not expect. So we see this first act of kindness where he basically says, stay here in this field. In other words, I'll protect you. Not only that, I've told my guys not to harass you, to leave you alone. But in addition to that, when you're thirsty, you can go right up to where my own people get their water. Second act of kindness is found in verses 10 through 13. So Ruth here fell on her face, bowing to the ground and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? She recognized this amazing act of grace and kindness. And again, she doesn't really know who he is at this point. So she wonders why in the world he would take pity on her. It's not enough that he took pity on just a widower that's taking from his field, but that she's a foreigner. Remember, Moabites were not welcome in Israel. They couldn't go into the temple. They were excluded from certain things. They were the enemies. They tormented Israel in many respects over the years. And so she sees this as an amazing act of grace. So Boaz replies to her in verse 11, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. So Ruth's reputation preceded her here. Boaz tells us that he probably learned it from one of his servants. And what he reflects on about her is that she had been faithful to Naomi. She left her own people, came to Israel, and he saw that as an honorable thing. So he's returning the kindness to her. Verse 12, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be paid or be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. And so basically he now pronounces a blessing upon her, a foreigner, that God might bless her because she has come to take refuge under Israel. So then she responds to him and she says, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. She recognized that she's an outsider. She recognized that she didn't deserve his kindness, just because of social standards and other things. You know, it's interesting, I was watching I was flipping through the channels and they came across the Inspiration Channel and Daniel Boone was on. And I don't even know what, I think it was made back in the 60s. And it was interesting because the storyline was basically that there was this slave who had been taken and brought here, and the slave had escaped his master and wanted to go back to Africa. And so he was stealing pelts, animal furs, and then selling them to a bad man to make money to basically purchase his way to go back to Africa. And it was rather interesting because as the story unfolds, Daniel Boone is this, in some respects, like a Christ-like figure. He's just gracious and kind and thoughtful in that. And there's a scene where the black guy, the slave, and Daniel Boone are interacting about Daniel Boone's treatment of him. Because the black guy said, you know, whites and blacks don't get along. They can't be friends. Well, then this Indian friend of Daniel Boone's comes in to the story, and there's sort of the three of them are there, and the black man's having a hard time going, well, how come an Indian and a white man are friends? And as the story unfolds, the Indian says, basically, Daniel Boone not only is my friend, but he's given his life for me in a lot of respects. He's saved me many times. And it's interesting because as the story unfolds, what you find is that the black guy says, but this isn't the way it is. I'm an outsider. You shouldn't be my friend. And Daniel Boone kind of ignores that, and so it kind of all works out. And it's kind of the picture that Naomi has here, that Ruth has here, that I'm a foreigner. I don't deserve your kindness. I'm from the outside. But you've shown me this grace and this mercy and this kindness. And when we remember that Ruth represents the church, what does that say about us, folks? Same thing. We were foreigners. We weren't part of God's people, if you will. We didn't deserve God's grace, his mercy, his kindness, and yet that's exactly what he extended to us. Let's go ahead and move on. There's a third act of kindness here that Boaz extends, and it's found in verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. So the third act of kindness is here. He actually feeds her too. But you notice who she's sitting and eating with? With the reapers, yeah. Brought her right up to the table. But you notice something else in this text? What does it say that he did for her? It says that he served her. Isn't that rather interesting? Here she is, she's a reaper, and typically you would expect at this time that Boaz would sit off maybe with some of his managers and eat at their table with the best of the food. And then you might have the reapers over here with their sack lunches and whatnot. And then you might have the rest the scavengers that had come through the field that were probably sitting off in the field. And yet here he takes her and brings her all the way up to eat with all the reapers. And not only that, it says that he fed her. It says that he served her. Again, it's an interesting picture of the church, isn't it? What did Christ say? He came what? Yeah, not to be served, but to... Yeah. To serve. Yeah. And what we find in the story here is that she not only ate enough to be satisfied, but she had some left over too. Again, a picture of us with Christ and the church. God not only satisfies us, he goes beyond satisfying us, that we might have something left over. There's a fourth act of kindness, and that's in verses 15 through 17. So this is probably midday. They're probably having their lunch, if you will. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her." So he starts off and he says, okay, we're going to have her go back out. And he basically says, I want you to make sure that Ruth doesn't have to tag along behind you, but actually goes with you as reapers, and let her actually reap. Not to glean, pick up the scraps, but let her actually go and reap with you. But then he takes it a step further. Look at what he does in verse 16. Well, he tells him, first of all, not to insult her, but to treat her as another reaper. Verse 16, "Also you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." So basically he says, okay, when you get done and you bundle up, you know, the reapers would take these, basically you've seen in the fields today, even the big wheels you see, or sometimes the standing grain where they tie it all up. Well, basically they said, okay, when you do that, then go and yank some of the good stuff out of there and put it down for her that she can pick it up. And so he not only says, let her glean with you, but then take some of the good stuff, pull it down so she doesn't have to work for it, just to gather it up herself. So he goes above and beyond again in this fourth act here. In fact, what's interesting is he went beyond the letter of the law. Did you catch that? The law said, just leave them the corners and don't interrupt while they pick up the scraps. But Boaz understood the spirit of the law, and so he went above and beyond the letter of the law. Same thing for us, isn't it? You know, we're supposed to understand the spirit of the word, not just the letter. And so Boaz here, you can already see his character, and you can see who he was. And he didn't just obey the Lord because the law said it, but it was something that probably arose from within his heart. He understood the spirit of it. So he goes even further, having them deliberately pull out grain. And what's interesting about that is gleaning involved a heck of a lot of work. It was not an easy job. In fact, most of the time these folks would glean all day and barely have enough to eat. Because you can imagine, again, as these guys would go through their fields, paying attention to the letter of the law, if they even did that, you know, just leaving barely enough on the ground. And so you had to gather up an awful lot just to get enough grain to maybe have a meal. And so it was hard work. But what we find here with her is that when she gets done, the estimate here, if you look at... what she walked away with is probably 30 pounds of grain when she's all done. So she, because of Boaz's goodness and grace to her, she walks away with a pretty hefty amount of food and grain from a day's work. It says in verse 17, so she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. That's about 30 pounds. That's after she got, that's not 30 pounds of the stalks. That's pure grain when she's all done, pure barley, which again was a significant amount of food after a day's work. So, what happens after this? Look at verses 18 and following. Ruth now is done with her day, so she heads home. She arrives back home. She sees Naomi, shows her what she's gleaned, and she even has some leftover food for her from the meal. Look at verse 18. She took it up, and she went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw that she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. So she gives her part of her food. So earlier when we saw that she had not only been satisfied, but had something left over, she had enough to take home to Naomi as well. I'm sure Boaz made sure of it. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where did you work?" Remember I said that verse 1 was actually an introductory verse? Naomi didn't know where Ruth is going. Just knew she's going out to a field somewhere. Didn't know it would be Boaz. "May he who took notice on you be blessed." So she, Ruth, told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative or our kinsman. He is one of our closest relatives." So basically what Naomi does here is she recognizes as Ruth comes home, she's probably shocked because of the stuff that Ruth came home with, because she probably didn't expect a whole lot other than maybe enough for a meal. And Naomi comes home with a bag of groceries and says, "Here, look, this is what was left over for my lunch." Drops it down. And then she says, "And oh, by the way, I got 30 pounds of barley here." And no doubt, Naomi's thinking, "Wow, what happened here? Where'd you go?" She says, "Well, I went to this field. Some dude named Boaz was kind to me." And all of a sudden, the lights go on, because Naomi knew who Boaz was, but didn't know that Naomi had gone to glean in his fields. And part of the reason for this is it appears that, well, we know from the story here that Boaz was a distant relative, but he wasn't the first relative in line to help her family out. We'll see that in a little bit. So she sounds like she never even thought of Boaz prior to this, but she's shocked in some respects here, and she says, "Wow, well, this is Boaz. He's a close relative. He's a kinsman. He's a redeemer." All of a sudden it clicks, and she's thinking about the law, and she recognizes that Boaz is somebody who can redeem her family, somebody that can rescue her family. The Old Testament kinsman redeemer was a male relative who was responsible under the Old Testament law to care for another relative in time of need or trouble. The way God set it up was that if you fell into difficulty, your closest relative was supposed to help you out, supposed to take care of you. And this would include all kinds of things. It would, I'll give you a couple of examples here. If somebody got murdered, he was supposed to step in and help to resolve that. He was supposed to buy back family members who had been sold into slavery. They were generally to look after, to help care for, if their bills needed to be paid or food needed to be provided. Those were all things that the closest relative was supposed to do. So a good example might be my brother David. If my brother David, he's married with his own family. If I were to die and my family was left destitute in some respects, if we were Hebrew, David would have some responsibility for my wife and my kids under God's law, to help out, to care for. If he were single, then it would be expected he would marry Amy. That's the way the law spelled it out. And that's really where this becomes critical, because there's two more, I guess, important or prominent roles of the kinsman redeemer. One was to marry a childless widow of a relative in order to care for her by providing offspring for the dead. You notice she said here that he had been good to the living and the dead? What she's basically saying is Boaz, as a kinsman, has taken care of the living, us, and the dead, which are his relatives. Because that was the responsibility. And what he was supposed to do was actually, if he was single, to marry the wife, the widow of the dead man, not just to care for her, but to provide offspring, so that the name would be continued on, so that no name was lost in Israel. So in other words, in case, again, with David and me, the idea would be that if Amy was a widow and didn't have any children, that David would marry her to father children so that my name would be carried on. Because those children, even though they were David's children, would be seen as my children and would have my name, so that my name would be continued on in the line of Israel. That was one of the responsibilities of the kinsman redeemer. And she recognizes that here with Boaz. The second thing, they were supposed to buy back land that had been sold to bring it back under the family. In other words, and we'll see this here next week, is that Naomi, because she's in such a difficult spot, has to sell the land that belonged to her family, to Elimelech. She needs the money. And the kinsman redeemer is supposed to come back and buy that property back and let it go back into the family so that Naomi's, when she has children then, or with Ruth, when Ruth has children, that they would inherit that land. And that land wouldn't end up in somebody else's portfolio, if you will, especially a foreigner. So the kinsman redeemer had two primary responsibilities here as it relates to our story. One is to marry the widow, to care for her, and to provide offspring for her husband. The second thing he's supposed to do is buy back her land if she's forced to sell it. And all these things are swirling around in Naomi's head at this point, because she realizes that that's who this man is, that he's the closest relative. And at this point, you could almost say that in Naomi, you begin to see a little bit of hope for the first time. Remember when she came back to the land and she said, "The Lord has dealt bitterly with me. His hand is against me." Now there's a little bit of hope. Because this man, who is a kinsman redeemer, has showed kindness. And she probably recognizes what Boaz has done. It's pretty clear, the way she's speaking of Boaz here, that he recognized, at least, that he was a relative. But what's interesting is, as we'll see next week, he knew he wasn't the first relative in line. He knew there was another man who was ultimately, by law, responsible. But here's the kicker to this. Remember, Boaz here isn't living by the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. And so he acts as a kinsman redeemer, even though he is not legally obligated by the law, at least in a small way. He looks at Ruth and he says, "I'm going to provide for her. You stay in my field. I will now provide for you. But also, take enough back to take care of Naomi as well." And so he has now taken Naomi and Ruth under his wings in some respects to care for them, because he understands the spirit of the law. And again, he's not legally obligated to it, and we'll see how that works itself out in the next 2 weeks. And so we have this kinsman redeemer here in Naomi blessing him. She says, may he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living or the dead. I like the translation of the NET a little bit better. It says, "The Lord bless him. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." If you look at this text, there's some controversy over it, because when you look at verse 20 there, where it says, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness," it looks like she's saying the Lord has not removed his kindness, but it's actually a reference to Boaz himself. And there are some other translations like the NET that make that a little more clear. She's not basically thanking God here for not removing his kindness, but Boaz. She's recognized that he's the one, and obviously he's a tool of God at this point. So what happens with the rest of the story here? Well, look at verse 21. "Then Ruth the Moabitess said, 'Furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest.'" And there we see Boaz again caring for her. He said, "The rest of the harvest, you're here. You're working in my fields." "Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids so that others do not fall upon you in another field.'" Remember I talked about how dangerous it was? It's exactly what she's recognizing here. Hey, he's invited you to stay with him, because it's dangerous out there. Verse 23, "So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law." So what do we have in this story today? I love the fact that we're introduced to this man, Boaz, because he's the kind of guy that when you look at him, you think, wow, this is a man who lived his faith. Again, you know, you look at him and there's all these little intricate things here that he didn't have to do that he did anyway. And some of those things even would have been probably against the norm in his culture. You know, it's almost like my dad tells this story about how when he worked at the Green Bay paper, the Fort Howard paper factory in Green Bay. It was a family-owned newspaper. It was the only non-union paper factory in the whole area, but it was the largest tissue paper manufacturer in the world. And it was owned by the Coffrin family, A.E. Coffrin. And what's really neat about this is A.E. Cofran would show up at all hours of the day and go walk through the factory and shake the hands and talk to his employees. Everyone from the managers all the way down to the guys that were sweeping the floor. And sometimes he'd bring in bags of popcorn for his employees. And what was interesting about that is, in that particular area, most of the paper factories were all union, where there was always divisiveness and tension between the management and the union employees. Because the management wasn't union. And there was always this tension, you know? But at Fort Howard, you'd be working, you know, packing your napkins off the plant at 3 o'clock in the morning, working the graveyard shift, and all of a sudden, here comes A.E. Cofran walking up alongside you and hands you a bag of popcorn and sits down and chats with you. Didn't have to do that. But you look at him and go, wow, I'd like to know that guy. Here's a, you know, he owns a paper factory, largest in the world, and here he is chumming around with guys on the line at 3 in the morning. There was a guy when I was in seminary, Seymour Cray. Cray Supercomputers, they made the world's fastest computers back in the 80s and 90s. And their factory and their place was right there in Chippewa Falls, about 20 minutes north of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And this guy, you'd see him driving around town in his old beat-up Nova. Blue jeans, t-shirts, you know. And yet the guy was running the most powerful supercomputer company in the world at the time. My buddy, one of my roommates, actually worked for him. And he said, this guy is so down to earth. He treats us all like royalty when we go in, you know. So when you look at Boaz, you kind of see something like that. You go, wow, this guy understood the spirit of the law. And he's good to his people. And he recognizes he's got a responsibility to Naomi, even though legally, by the law, he could have said, it's not my problem. But yet he recognizes that. And it's because of where he is in his relationship with Yahweh. And you see that begin to be oozed out of here. And so you see this hope begin to kind of creep in here with this story. And so I look at that and I think, man, don't you all just want to be like Boaz? And I told you that as we went through the story that the young women would see somebody they could emulate in Ruth. And the young boys, I told you there'd be somebody they could emulate in Boaz. You know, look at what happened with this election season and think about now the bitterness and the animosity and some of the hate and stuff like that right now that's going on. We just get nasty, don't we, as people? You know, there's no kindness, no grace, no gentleness, you know. It almost seems like that's the odd thing sometimes. And so we look at this man, Boaz, and we see how his faith has impacted him. And again, he goes above and beyond the letter of the law to the grace that's built into the law. So we got that, you know. We have somebody we can emulate, somebody we could be like. Tells us how to live out our faith. But we also see, again, in Ruth here, somebody who desperately needs to be cared for. Foreign widow in a land where she has no hope. And just by chance, she happens to end up in Boaz's field. Do you think it really is that way? Do you really think she ended up there just by chance? I mentioned to you, one of the themes that flows through this book of Ruth is the theme of God's providence. And I love the fact that it's presented very subtly throughout this book. Just like this. She just happened to come upon the field. And it just happened to be a kinsman redeemer. And it just happened to be a guy with the gracious attitude that Boaz had. And it just so happens that he went above and beyond and gave her more than she needed so she could also go home to Naomi. It's the author's way of teaching us about the providence of God and his sovereignty. These people that desperately needed him when they returned back to Israel. And it got so bad, we'll see this next week, where Naomi had to sell her land in desperate straits, and God took care of it. And when you remember that Ruth is a representation or a type of the church, what does that say about us? It tells me that there's providence in our salvation, meaning we didn't just happen to stumble upon it. When I got saved in college, I think about everything I did to avoid getting saved, and I did. It wasn't that I didn't want to know God. I would pray. I would walk out. I'd go out at walks at 2 a.m. sometimes and just pray. But I didn't have a personal relationship with Christ. And I would say, God, you got to do something. I need, you know. And yet I look back at the number of things that God had done to move me to exactly where I was the day that I sat down with Bob Kegel and literally asked him to share the gospel with me when this guy had been trying for 6 months to just open a little crack. And I asked myself, that all just happened? That I just happened to end up at Eau Claire? That I just happened to end up at towers on the 10th floor, that I just happen to bring my guitar one day when Bob went, oh, that's the way I can get to this guy. He wants to play guitar and I can teach him that. That all just happen? Well, Ephesians chapter 1 says that God chose us before the foundation of the world. And that doesn't always make sense to us because we sort of think, well, but what about free will? We get all these crazy, you know what? Argument for a different time, but the reality of it is God chose us. He chose the church. He chose us Gentiles. It's all a part of his providence. And that's exactly what we see in this picture of the story of Ruth. God knew. God did. There's a tremendous amount of security, and as we look at Ruth and think, wow, we see some hope now. We see that she will be cared for, provided for, taken care of by God's providence.